The Marine Corps Tactical System Support Activity, or MCTSSA, provides 24/7 global technical support for command, control, computer, communication, cyber, and intelligence systems, and conducts engineering, testing, and evaluation, and supports experimentation on CSI systems and amphibious platforms in order to inform acquisition decisions and make the Fleet Marine Force more capable. Today, I had the chance to speak with the commanding officer for MCTSSA, Colonel Craig Clarkson. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Tripp. Thanks for having me.
Well, so before we really get into this, I want to welcome you to the East Coast. For anyone that doesn't know, MCTSSA is on the West Coast, so welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? How did you end up working for the Marine Corps and here at Systems Command?
Yeah, sure thing, Tripp. I born and raised in Massachusetts. I went to college on the East Coast in a city called Worcester, Mass. Went to school called the College of the Holy Cross. And Holy Cross is a school where a lot of the kids go there, end up going to, you know, either become a doctor, a lawyer, or work on Wall Street. And none of those things appealed to me. So I remember it was, you know, sometime around my senior year, and I was kind of wandering through the student center, pondering my future, you know, kind of an internal crisis as everybody was like interviewing for jobs and whatnot. And it was like, I have no idea what I want to do when I grow up. And as I came to the door by the student center, I stumbled across a Marine captain in his dressed blue Deltas. And he had one of those old time AV carts, you know, with the squeaky wheels and the VCR and the, you know, 20-inch TV on it. And, you know, on the TV screen, there was a bunch of, you know, Marines running across the beach and jets coming across and, you know, shooting stuff. And I was like, oh, hell yeah. That's what I want to do when I grow up. So kind of went from there, went to the OSO office in Boston, you know, joined the Marine Corps, and then became a combat engineer officer. And so I did that for my first tour, and then came to SysCom for my second tour as a first lieutenant, which is a weird thing to be coming to SysCom. I think I was filling a major's billet at PM Engineers at the time. It was right at the start of OIF-1, and it was like urgent, uncentral, like all kinds of money coming in. Of course, in the engineer community, it was, you know, we were doing all the things counter IED at the start of that, and it was a really exciting time to be here. You know, half the workforce at the time was Marine, half civilian, a little bit different mix than what it was now. We actually were in the laundry building, a different part of the.
I remember that building well.
Yeah, and then they were remodeling this building we're sitting in now, 2200. We ended up down in the basement with PM engineers, and it was like a flurry of activity every day. You know, phones ringing, people doing stuff, getting stuff downrange. And I got to deploy twice out of SysCom as a lieutenant and then captain. Actually got promoted while I was deployed and just had a really fantastic time. And always thought I might want to do this kind of thing later in my career. And then, of course, the acquisition MOS came around after I'd already left. I talked to my old program manager, Bill Massasevic, and also I'd worked for Major Ben Garza back then and Major Joe Klosik, who were some of my mentors. The feedback I got was like, hey, you know, recommend you continue doing Marine stuff out in the fleet for as long as you can. And then, you know, you can always come back home to SysCom later. So I, as an engineer, I did all the, you know, engineer things. I commanded all the way up through the 05 level and then got selected for TLS. And I asked to go to the Eisenhower School because I knew they had this thing called the Senior Acquisition Course. So I went there, did the senior acquisition course, and applied to become, you know, an 8061, and I obviously was selected. And I got sent for Fort Meade for a few years to stand up a program office up there, and now I'm out at MCTSSA.
That is a huge amount for me to unpack. So let me try to go by memory from the beginning. So Worcester, Mass.
Worcester.
Okay. So if anybody not from New England is looking for that on a map, it's spelled like Worcester
right? That's right.
And then, you know, the names you talked, those were heady days back, you know, early in OIF. And I think Ben Garza just retired this last year.
That's right.
And I mean, those were phenomenal folks that you learned from. And we're glad that they were there to give you some mentorship. And now you're colonel and running MCTSSA. So you talked a little bit, you're a collector of MOSs. Did we miss any MOSs during your intro there?
So, yeah, I'm an acquisition officer, 8061, also a combat engineer. And then I've got two of the, you know, the other acquisition, MOS 8057, 8058, joint specialty officer. So joint qualified, I did that. I was working at Southcom for a few years. I worked in the counter-narcotics program, which is a story for another day. That was like the coolest job ever. I'm a planning, programming, and budgeting officer, a winter mountain leader, aviation ground support, weapons and tactics instructor, and operational advisor.
So is that nine?
I don't know.
Eight, nine? All right. Maybe somebody can listen to the podcast and count those up. So So one of the most well-schooled Marines here at the command, then, I'm sure.
Well, I just kind of stumbled into different things, you know, so, and then applied for the MOS when I had the opportunity. So,
cool deal. Yeah. So MCTISA, everybody thinks of MCTISA different things. I think of MCTISA. I think of the Amphibious Vehicles Test Branch. But that, of course, falls under your command, but it's just one of many of the different parts. Can you give us an overview of MCTISA's mission and how are you organized?
I didn't know what MCTISA was before I got out there. I knew it was something on the West Coast. I thought it was like, you know, IT help desk or something, and they did some kind of testing with like command and control systems. I went out there and got the first overview brief before I took over, and it was just like my mind was blown. Couldn't believe all the things going on there because I had no idea. And even now in the job, I realize a lot of people don't really know, but they're starting to learn as we're doing a whole bunch of things to support a force design. We accomplished that through a couple of our divisions. I'm going to talk about, actually, it's interesting, we're going through reorg of sorts right now to better align for some of the things we're doing. But I'll talk about what we were a couple weeks ago and what we are now.
Okay.
Some of the divisions have stayed the same. So the first is Warfighter Support Division, and this is the organization that provides the 24/7 global technical support for all C4I systems that we have in the Marine Corps. And it's the primary interface for the FMF. You know, they have that help desk. It's a tiered system. You know, you call anytime you need to. Somebody's going to be there to answer the phone and help you troubleshoot. If they can't solve the problem, it goes to like a tier two person who's an expert in like a family of systems that you're interested in. If they can't solve the problem from there, they'll actually replicate the architecture that you've got in the lab environment and troubleshoot on the fly. And they have a world-class like kind of ticketing system where they track exactly who called in, what the issue was, you know, how long it took to resolve. And they collect all that, all those metrics so they can provide feedback to the program offices on problem areas and what we need to address.
With that 24/7, so you've got the systems that you're expecting calls for. Do you ever get just random calls for another piece of gear that isn't what you were planning to provide tech support on?
We do on occasion, and in those cases, we just try to direct the folks who are calling in to the right folks to help them out.
Find the right SME.
That's right.
Okay.
So when I say that group is global, I mean truly global. It's not just out at Camp Pendleton. We've got a footprint in Okinawa. We have a footprint in Germany, Nola in Bahrain, some folks at Lejeune, and in the National Capital Region as well. So they're there to provide over-the-shoulder support in like whatever region the Marines might need help as well. In addition to all that work, they're also doing a lot of software development right now. So some of our young engineers that we're getting in are really good at writing code, and we've got some expert software folks on that team. They're helping a bunch of different organizations work on some of the tactical problems that where we can throw a software solution at it and fix it. So they're working very closely with the Army Software Factory and the Marine Corps Software Factory, which is a new thing. They also are a primary interface on the Tactical Assault Kit Product Center. So I don't know if you're familiar with TAC, but it's a tactical application for common tactical picture, a lot of interest across the DoD, kind of grassroots. So doing a lot of work with them. And in fact, MCTISA sits on the configuration steering board for that organization to help guide the direction of the TAC Product Center in the direction that the Marine Corps needs it. In addition, WSD is doing a lot of work with OWN's force signature management, like monitoring the electromagnetic spectrum and helping tactical units figure out how to manage their TTPs and SOPs. And then a lot of work on like the Sense Make Sense piece, work in collaboration with McWill. And some of the software work that they're doing there helps with that effort. Like they're working right now for some of the commercial off-the-shelf radar systems. How do you translate that data into cursor on target to go into a platform like TAC?
Now, when you're working with McWill or with the other systems that you're talking about, do you work with them or on your own for transition to a program of record?
So, yes. So there's a lot of work right now, a lot of interest with PFM CES and some other program offices around the Marine Corps Enterprise about like, you know, how can TAC enable some of the systems we have right now? What is the same or different in terms of some of our programs of record? What can we leverage from that ecosystem? So we try to work that feedback loop so that everybody's understanding like what we're learning as we go and then take those lessons to apply to the program as they deem appropriate. You talked about AVTB already. Their primary customer is PM-AAA. They do all the testing on the ACV, AAV, ARV, you know, anything that goes in the water that has wheels and tracks, they do at their facility. And they have a world-class capabilities down there and really the expertise from the Marines on the littorals. And then they also have additive manufacturing capability so they can fabricate parts or whatever's needed, test articles, to put on to enhance the tests that they're doing. The big plus with AVTB is they're, you know, on Camp Pendleton, access to all the ranges and, you know, facilities to do whatever tests are necessary. So they're trying to work right now to pivot towards not just traditional, you know, program office support in the way they have been for PM AAA. That will always be their bread and butter. That will always be their focus. But they're trying to figure out how can they start doing some more testing for things for the littorals. People have recognized that they have like a world-class capability there and a lot of interest in AVTB. From there, we have, we had test and certification division, which does, you know, what the name implies,
right,
with test and certification. But they also have our naval integration team, which works to make sure that all the, you know, Marine Corps programs or programs that the Marine Corps uses interoperable with the Navy. We have our cyber assessment team or our blue team that works closely with MAR-4 Cyber. And their primary focus is cybersecurity on our programs of record or our critical programs. And then we have the JADC2 Battle Lab, which is of critical importance right now with everything happening with force design and our partnership with the Army and the Navy for Project Overmatch and Project Convergence. And then we also had Program Engineering and Support Division. And that division is, you know, we have the technical support officers that are the, you know, primary interface for the program offices that you know, need developmental testing and engineering done. And they are the subject matter experts on all the, you know, Marine Corps systems that we support. What we've done recently is we've kind of mashed those two organizations together because what I observed was fantastic work happening in both areas, but we were learning some things in the experimentation that we were doing that are critical for like what we need to do to pivot for the future. And that information wasn't always getting back to the folks that are in direct support of the programs. So we wanted to tighten that feedback loop, right? So as we're doing our program support, which is our primary, you know, our primary purpose, our primary why, like why we're there, we want to make sure that we're also having those folks work closely with the folks that are learning so we can accelerate, you know, this learning that's occurring in all the in the lab environment and help that feedback loop to the program offices. And then we also have Infrastructure and Information Support Division. They function as our like six, so to speak. They make sure that, you know, they run our NOC. They make sure that our lab environments are interconnected with all the other folks in you know, the developmental test and engineering community across the DoD. And also, interestingly enough, we have the new equipment training team for Nemesis out there, which doesn't belong to MCTISA. They're ADCON to MCTISA, but they belong to PFM GCES. And so we support those Marines and with all their administrative needs while they go execute their mission in support of the PFM. You know, we're comprised of, with the NET team, about 200 Marines, 160 civilians, 150 contractors. We have a lot of technical talent, like legit technical talent at MCTISA, people that are experts from, you know, working in that MOS as a Marine or as a sailor or whatever in their past life. And they come in and they work as an engineer in our lab environment. They're like super highly motivated workforce. We have the highest concentration of electrical engineers, computer scientists, and I think we get the biggest feed of naval postgraduate students at MCTISA across the Marine Corps. Our priorities are support to the program offices, number one, support to the warfighter, and then support to Force Design 2030. General Walsh and General Ellison signed a memorandum of agreement this past winter that established MCTISA as essentially the C5 ISRT experimentation hub for the service. In a lab environment, we have representative or actual systems that the Marine Corps uses to, you know, have the operators working hand in hand with the engineers and take that feedback and get it back to all the folks here in Quantico so they can make, you know, informed acquisition decisions, inform the requirements process. You know, so we support all of our adjacent units, right, from the PFMs, PM Traces, PM McCo. You know, we do a lot of work for PEO Digital, PO MLB, PO Land Systems, doing work now for Office of Naval Research, doing work for DCI, McWill, of course, CDD, CDI, IC4, MAR-4 PAC with both the MEFs, MAR-4 COM with 2MEF, and then the Marine Corps Information Command, MAR-4 Cyber, and their subordinate elements of MCOG, MCSIWIG, MAR-4 Space as well. Do some work for TCOM on occasion, a lot of collaboration with the Marine Corps Communications Electronics School. In fact, we teach some courses out there in our SATCOM lab. doing a lot of work in support of the Joint Staff J6 as it relates to JADC2. Have coalition partners up in MCTISA all the time, doing some work for 5G for OUSD R&E, doing some work with DARPA, supporting MECATIA, work with JITIC, and now the Strategic Capabilities Office as well. So huge list of stakeholders, a lot of activity happening out there at MCTISA, and we are a very busy place.
So every time I've ever worked with anybody from MCTISA, again, usually on the AVTV side, I've been super impressed with the professional attitude, the knowledge, the experience that everyone on that team brings to the field. But you talked about folks from the Naval Postgraduate School that you had the highest percentage. I'm thinking it's the climate is why you're keeping them. They don't want to leave Monterey. If they got to leave Monterey, maybe they can at least come to San Diego and be with you there.
Well, so yeah, I'll tell you, geography drives culture, right? And there's certainly something to be said about having like the best real estate in Southern California, arguably some of the best real estate in the United States. You know, we have a great mission, great place to be. And as a result of those two things, we do some pretty great work.
Now, I think you talked to it earlier, but you didn't use the term. I came out a couple years ago and I toured your facility and I did a whole bunch of things. And one thing I did is I went aboard USS MCTISA. For the listeners, can you explain what the USS MCTISA is? Why do we have it? Why do we call it that?
Yeah, so the USS MCTISA, otherwise known as the MAE or the MAGTAF Afloat Integration Environment, was a brainchild of one of the previous COs, realizing there was a need for some place to do like better naval integration. And so they built a lab environment that is a replica of the USS Macon Island. You walk in and it looks exactly like the Atlantic Force Operations Center for the Macon Island. It actually, looks and smells.
Smells like it too.
Yeah. Right. And what we do is in that environment, we integrate all the Navy and Marine Corps systems for the naval environment. And, the MEUs come out there to our facility to train before they get aboard a ship for that representative environment. And then we figure out like, hey, you're going to have these systems on this specific, amphib, and you're planning on bringing these systems with you. Do they work? What do we need to troubleshoot? And what are the TTPs you're going to use to enable the force?
I mean, the answer is they don't work. And therefore, what do we have to troubleshoot to make them work?
Lots of troubleshooting. The Naval Integration Team does some really fantastic work with all of the, PMW whatevers that are out there that, represent the Navy and have their systems. And what's interesting with that team is because of the engineering expertise we have, sometimes they'll find, some kind of thing like an antenna that the Navy uses is going to get rid of and like, hey, we need it to do this thing. And they figure out a way to, re-engineer the thing to make it work. So they're really doing a lot of, that Naval Integration Team is doing a lot of important work. And it's driven again by some of our, fantastic civilian workforce. And then the folks that we get from the Naval Postgraduate School with recent relevant education on, how we need to make all the systems work.
So what formal role does MCTISA play in T&E on various systems?
When programs are trying to bring something to, start up a new program, bring something to fruition, they'll partner with us or in some cases, with the NIWICs and start doing that developmental testing to make sure that whatever the thing they're bringing out is going to meet the system requirements. Once the system's delivered, there's like, we'll get requests from the program managers to say, hey, we'd really like you guys to try this thing to see if we can enhance the capability of this program we have. We want you to test it in a systems of systems environment that really replicates like how the MAGTAF's going to be using it. Or, we have this, new software version that we need to put out and need you guys to test in the lab, make sure it doesn't screw anything up with the architecture it's going to be in. The great thing about MCTISA is that we're mission funded. So we're like pretty responsive. It's pretty common that we'll get a call from somebody, whether it be at DCI or IC4 or the MAF or the program office saying, hey, I got this kind of emergency thing that I need fixed like right now. Can you do that? And we'll say, sure. And we kind of, reprioritize what we're doing and then make the thing happen so that we can, the Marines can continue the fight.
We talk about Force Design 2030 on the podcast a lot. We talk about it in our day-to-day jobs. Can you give us some specifics about what are you doing at MCTISA in support of making Force Design 2030 a living, breathing thing?
I am personally really excited about force design. I think our culture is driven a bit by like, kind of go back to this story I was telling about the being in the student center and seeing the video of the, you know, amphibious assault and, like, you know, this idea of Marines coming across the beach and jamming a bayonet in someone's chest, like, hoorah, totally awesome, you know, bringing the fight to the enemy. And that culture is important, but I think that, like, that commercial, so to speak, is going to, like, change a little bit, right? Because the job in the future is to enable the joint force, be the sense, make sense, recon, counter recon, and be able to take what we're learning, take the information, take the data that we get in the battle space and pass that back to the, you know, the joint force, so they can make decisions about how they're going to target, how they're going to, you know, engage, what types of effects do they want to have on the adversary. And the Marine Corps is very kinetic thinking, and, you know, again, the bayonet in the chest kind of thing, rifleman first, all that, and that's all important, but, you know, there's other effects to be had in the information environment, and then there's, like, cyber effects, and there's all kinds of stuff like that, and, like, so force design, I see, like, some of the things that are going on, and you know, I see this with, you know, the latest update that was put out, where, like, how do we get after, you know, the full MAGTAF C2, where it's no longer just, like, aviation-centric or ground-centric, and then, like, how do you bring in the space picture, and how do you bring in the cyber picture, and how do you bring in, like, all of the, you know, national level capabilities so that, you know, the Marine Standing Force has that information, understands what's going on, and can pass relevant data back to decision makers at the joint level. You know, I look at this latest update, and I was flipping through. I was like, oh, hell yeah. This is exactly what we're working on right now. I looked at, you know, page 6, 7, 8 of the document. You talk about, you know, the directed actions and issues requiring further analysis, specifically with command and control, intelligence information, MAGTAF command and control, multi-domain reconnaissance, naval integration of C5I systems, information, maneuver mobility, sea-based expeditionary forces. And I look at some of this stuff, you know, MAGTAF command and control says the Marine Corps must be organized, trained, and resourced to effectively conduct C2 at echelon and rapidly transition across the competition continuum to enable all domain joint and combined kill webs. To do this, we must transition from a legacy air-land battle paradigm to a 21st century all-domain joint single battle mindset. We can no longer accept multiple disparate C2 systems optimized for single domain awareness bound by analog human speed processing. There are a variety of ongoing efforts to evolve services C2 capability to conduct all domain operations, enable kill webs, and further expand our value to the joint and combined force. And that's, like, exactly the stuff we're working on.
That's your wheelhouse.
That's it, you know. And that's part of, that's why McWill wanted to have, you know, this MOA with us to kind of, you know, we were doing this anyways. Like, value of an MOA is that, like, it codifies what everybody's doing so that, like, all of the stakeholders understand. And in particular, in any organization, you'll have senior leaders who are having these conversations, and the senior leaders have the benefit of getting all the classified briefs and getting, like, briefed constantly by experts on all the things. And they have a mental model of, like, how things should be working and how everybody should be working together. But then the folks who are in the trenches don't always have the benefit of that same kind of detailed information. And so codifying some of this stuff in an MOA allows you push that down to the folks at the tactical edge, and they read it and understand it, and they're like, okay, I get it. This is why we're working together on this stuff. We're the MAGTAF, right? Marine Air Ground Task Force. So we have equities with the Air Force. We have equities with the Army. We have equities with the Navy. And the systems that we buy and employ in many cases are not, like, Marine Corps unique things. We're really, like, a great place for the joint force to work for integration of all these systems, because we have the representative systems and we have expertise on Army things, on Navy things, on Air Force things. And so, that's why, you know, so many folks are wanting to come out to MCTISA and understand what's happening.
Talk to me a little bit about our industry partners. What's your relationship with industry, and, you know, what would you like to see out of industry in the next couple of years?
I think the real challenge is that, like, we are not on the government side particularly clear in what our demand signal is. And some of that is a function of uncertainty with budgets. You know, then there's shifting priorities. I do think the Marine Corps has done a really good job of, like, you know, putting out documentation like Force Design 2030. We're articulating what it is that we need. I see on the aviation side of the Marine Corps, I think the aviation side does this real well, where they engage with industry from DC Aviation and kind of give a, like, here's a strategic picture of, like, what we're going to do and where we need to go and all that. I think a little bit easier to project when you're talking about big platforms. On the IT side, it's like, man, things change so fast. It's hard to say, like, what we want. And you know, we're trying to learn as we go. You know, it's hard to put together a PWS that says, this is what my MAGTAF all-domain C2 thing's going to look like. Like, how do you do that, right? I think the best way to try to do some of this stuff is through, you know, sometimes it, like CRADE is a great instrument to bring industry in and do cooperative development as you're learning, they're learning, and then they kind of figure where you're trying to go. But I think, you know, again, the challenge is, like, how much money are we going to have available? Mm-hmm. What are our requirements?
When will you have it?
Yeah, when are we planning on buying the thing? How certain are we're going to stay in that direction? And if we can get a little bit better about, you know, I'm talking about, like, government as a whole, but, like, you know, the DoD, if we can get a little bit better about projecting what our needs are, I'm fairly certain industry will respond.
We talk a lot here on the podcast about getting Marine feedback, interaction with Marines. I understand that you at MCTISA have some tools that are specifically designed to help get that sort of feedback. What can you tell us about that?
We do a lot of partnering. You know, one of the, again, great things about our location is that we're co-located with the biggest MEF, right? And so we have folks from the operating forces up in our labs constantly working with our teams, you know, getting feedback from the operator on what their needs are, like how they actually employ systems. We try to get that information back to the decision makers here in Quantico, increasingly trying to tighten that feedback loop to CDD as well. It's a linear process. Like, you know, McWill learned something, you know, pass that information to CDD, validate a requirement, palm for money, transition to the program office. And like, we kind of have to get out of that waterfall-ish type approach. And so, you know, again, with a partnership that that we have with the operating forces, a partnership we have with Will, and you know, continuing the feedback loop with CDD while we maintain our regular comms with the program offices, I think we can do a lot to speed up the feedback loop and make some more decisions on the fly. So that's one piece, just like kind of where we are, who comes to see us, and all that. So we get a lot of feedback that way. The other piece, the way some of the great tools we have for the operating forces, all provided by largely Warfighter Support Division. The entry point is their portal. You know, you can just go Google, you know, Warfighter Support Division, and up pops our webpage here through SysCom. And on that site, you've got an equipment feedback portal. So you can, you know, if you got a problem with the system or a routine problem, you can go in and like log that, and we collect that data. We have another link that's like for systems training and has all the reference manuals for all the relevant systems we support. We have a chat link, so you can get in there and start chatting live with somebody, or you can pick up the phone and call. A few years back, we did something with PM Infantry Weapons, where they asked us to build like a build software that would support learning on our infantry weapons. So if you go in that portal, you can get to these links that have, you know, it's designed almost like a Call of Duty kind of thing, right? Where you get in and you see here's the picture of the weapon. Here's how it works, here's how you load it, here's the types of munitions that go in it, and you get all the visuals that go with that. And then we have, similar to that, we have a TechTube link, so actual videos of our Warfighter Support Division guys and gals working on a system, showing you how, here's how you connect this, here's how you plug this in, here's how you put the fill in, whatever. Call anytime, and somebody's going to be there to help you. So those are, you know, some of the tools we use to engage with and help the operating force.
24/7. There we go. All right, so before I move on to the lightning round questions, I would like you to be a commercial for the acquisition MOS, or maybe someone who wants to considering coming and being a civilian employee here at the command.
All right, so am I doing a sales commercial?
I don't know. What do you got? Tell us how great it is.
All right, so I think that the acquisition MOS is a really, really important MOS, despite some of the disparaging comments that people make about acquisition in general. You know, there's a difference between procurement and acquisition. Anybody can go buy something, but it's really hard to like buy something and deliver it and have all the spare parts and have all the technical manuals and have all the training set up and all that stuff.
Have it certified to go on a plane, certified to go on a ship.
Oh yeah, all of it, right? Like that's hard work. And unfortunately, it takes a little bit of time. I do think there are ways that we can go a little bit faster sometimes and do some things in parallel, and we continue to work on that to improve. What I've enjoyed about being an acquisition officer is that like there's a real opportunity to make a difference for the future of the Marine Corps. I'll just add that I think the benefit to having people in uniform is, one, the recent relevant expertise in whatever their specific skill set is. Two, recent relevant experience with the MAGTAF and understanding like what the Marines' needs are. But three, being able to leverage the uniform to work relationships with other, you know, some with peers that work in different organizations that you may have gone to, you know, may have served in whatever unit with, may have gone to whatever school with. And that's the way you make things go fast, is you leverage relationships. And so being able to make a difference as a person in uniform, doing important, hard work in support of ensuring the Marine Corps has the best stuff we can afford going forward.
You know, you talk about recent and relevant experience with the equipment. I have also always, because I think you listed three things, I've always had a fourth one in my head. There's the expectation that a sizable percentage of our Marines will, in the future, go back out to the fleet and lead other Marines using the gear that has been acquired here at the command.
Yeah.
And so you want to make sure that your Marines in the future have the best gear you can put in their hands.
That's
so.
Right. And I think that, you know, for anybody who is contemplating coming to do a tour at CISCOM, whether there's whether, you know, you want to be an acquisition person or not, just the experience of working here is tremendously beneficial when you go back out to the, when you go out to the fleet. And so, and because I had learned like how this, how the machine works, how money works, how requirements work, how acquisition work, I was able to influence things in, you know, for my community working with then PM engineers, because I knew which levers to pull. So, you know, doing a tour here, whether you choose to stay or not as an acquisition person, is just going to make you a better Marine in the future.
Well, Colonel Clarkson, I cannot express enough how much I have enjoyed this conversation. I learn things every podcast that we do, and today is no exception. So I'm going to listen to this and look up some of the various divisions you're talking about and learn some more on my own. We've got this little thing that we do around here called our lightning round. Are you ready to?
Sure.
All right.
Fire away.
Here come your lightning round questions. When you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a state trooper.
A state trooper.
Mm-hmm.
In Massachusetts.
A Massachusetts statey.
Nice.
That's what I wanted to be.
All right.
They made a lot of money on details, my
okay.
dad told me.
All right. Your dad told you.
Yeah, my dad was a police officer too.
All right, if you could have dinner with any historical figure, who would it be?
Dwight Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower, good choice.
Yep. Yeah, he was, you know, general in Europe during World War II, president during the Cold War, fought for desegregation. He was big on balancing the budget, which I think is kind of a big deal. He was responsible for the highway system that we have. And I think if the one thing I would want to do is if I had an opportunity to meet with Eisenhower, if I could go back in time, I would have told him to make more lanes on I-95.
Start from the beginning rather yeah. than add them incrementally yeah. over time. So good deal. Yeah, if you had mentioned the highway system, I was going to, because their signs will say, you know, Dwight Eisenhower highway system. So good deal. All right. Do you have any tips for maintaining a work-life balance?
I'm like the wrong person to ask about that. I think people would tell you that I probably work too much, but
any lessons learned
yeah,
for doing
so
it wrong?
I think the key, like, I think people tend to look at the work-life balance as like a binary kind of arrangement, right? Like zero, I'm at work, one, I'm at home. You know, I go to work from these hours, I go home for these hours, I expect to have, you know, whatever the, it's like a division, I think, in some people's mind. In my mind, it's more fluid. If you can find work that you're passionate about, even if the work isn't obviously passionate to you, make it passionate to you, because you can make a difference regardless of where you're, you know, kind of bloom where you're planted. But if you're enthusiastic about what you're doing, then it becomes exciting to go to work. Like, I wake up every, like, I mean, I'm at MCTISA, right? So like
72 degrees every morning,
super,
I know.
Super easy for me to be excited about. Like, it's like the best job. I would have never in a million years thought I would have been there, but like the best job ever. And so super easy for me to be excited about it. But I've had some hard jobs too, where like, you know, sometimes it was hard to get up and go do the fight. But if you can set goals and like know you're going to move the ball for the organization and be excited about that and genuinely enthusiastic about it, then, you know, it doesn't seem so much like work. So like, you know, getting up early on the weekend, doing a little bit of work, no big deal. I'm working, you know, whenever there's downtime. And then you just, you know, make the time for all the other really important stuff with your family and everything. And then I don't worry about set hours. You know, I'm going to work a lot, but it's going to be fun and because it's something I'm excited about.
What is a TV show, book, movie, or podcast that you'd recommend?
Books. I always go to the, I go to the Commandant's Reading List, not because necessarily like I'm super moto, you know, Marine that like feels obliged to read the Commandant's Reading List, but because, you know, how awesome is it that you've got people that curate a reading list for you with some impactful books. So like I usually go there as my first reference. One that I think is relevant to like right now is, and I know a lot of people have talked about, is that book Kill Chain by Christian Bros. Well, I think, yeah, it talks a lot of challenge about the DOD, like where we are as a nation in competing with adversaries, but in particular challenges with the acquisition process as designed. And I think if you understand how it's designed, there's ways to work around it or work through it to achieve the objectives you're shooting for faster than the system was designed to do. And so I think that's like a, you know, one, that book highlights some of the threats, some of the risks, and two, might provide some insight for like how we can do things a little bit differently to, again, close that feedback loop so that we can take the greatest idea, the best new idea, and figure out how to like bring it to fruition and then sustain it a little bit faster than we typically have done in the past. And then podcasts, the one that's near dear to my heart is the Phoenix Cast, Network Task Force Phoenix. A couple of my buddies from Fort Meade started that program. It's about technology, innovation, and cybersecurity issues in the DOD. They get a lot of great guests on there. Every time I listen to that show, I learn something new. And it's all stuff that's relevant to the things that are happening, like time now in the Marine Corps.
Colonel Craig Clarkson, thank you very much for coming on the show today. It's been very enjoyable learning and having this conversation, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Thanks, Tripp. Appreciate you all having me. Thank you.
Well, this concludes another episode of Equipping the Corps. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation today. If so, please take a couple minutes to leave us a review, subscribe, and tell your friends about us. Until next time, stay safe. This is Tripp Elliott, signing off.